3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 65, Apollo 9. As we enter 1969, NASA is about to complete the next three Apollo missions, ending in a moon landing at a rapid pace of one mission every 2 months. Apollo 9 will launch on March 3, 1969. Apollo 10 will launch on May 18, 1969, and Apollo 11 will launch on July 16, 1969. The rapid pace in the 6 months leading up to the moon landing was possible only because of the groundwork that NASA had laid down over the last several years, namely with the Gemini program. Through the Gemini program, NASA learned the basics of spacecraft operations. NASA learned to maneuver spacecraft, rendezvous, dock, conduct extravehicular activities, and maintain communications and spacecraft operations for days at a time. So when the Apollo spacecraft were ready, NASA only needed to finish flight testing to confirm that the new equipment worked. The need to learn new skills by the astronauts, by mission control, and the launch operations team was kept to a minimum. I emphasize this point to dispel any notion that the Soviet Union could have caught up to perform a manned landing on the moon of its own if only a few lucky things happened and its rockets and spacecraft worked. By this time in early 1969, the Soviet Union had only just begun to learn the basics of maneuvering, rendezvous, docking, and EVAs. These were all skills that were prerequisite to landing on the moon, especially under the Soviet Union's N1L3 mission profile, which was in many ways far more complicated than the Apollo lunar landing mission profile. At this point, the Soviet Union needed far more than luck to land on the moon. It needed skill. Skill that it did not yet have. So, by early 1969, NASA was really racing against itself. To be exact, it was racing against the deadline imposed by President Kennedy in 1961 to land on the moon before 1970. The next step for NASA in its race to the moon was the Apollo 9 mission. The Apollo 9 mission was the first time that NASA would conduct a launch with all the equipment needed for a moon landing. The mission called for the use of the Saturn V to launch an Apollo command module, the service module, and the lunar module. Never before had NASA or the launch operations team at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida prepared a full stack as they would for the lunar landing. Previous missions had launched only a command module or only a lunar module. For Apollo 9, launching both at the same time represented a critical test. Apollo 9 was also the first time that NASA would launch a manned mission with the lunar module. As I mentioned in the episode on Apollo 8, the production of flight-ready lunar modules had fallen behind schedule. NASA had to direct the contractor, Grumman, to correct poor wiring and corrosion on the metals used for the lunar module. As a result, NASA was growing anxious about whether it had enough time to complete flight testing for the lunar module. flight testing the lunar module in a manned mission was especially important. The lunar module was unlike any other spacecraft. It was extremely lightweight and fragile. And that was when the lunar module was whole, including both the ascent and descent stages of the spacecraft. When returning from the moon, the astronauts would only be flying in the ascent stage, meaning the astronauts needed to learn how to cope with an even lighter and awkward-to-fly spacecraft. Flight testing the lunar module in Earth orbit before going to the moon was therefore essential. Apollo 9 was also the only mission to test the life support backpacks that would be used during the moon landing. The backpacks were officially known as the Extravehicular Mobility Unit, or EMUs. The EMUs were the backpacks that would provide the oxygen and temperature control for the astronauts while they were on the lunar surface. The astronauts selected for the Apollo 9 mission were James McDivitt, David Scott, and Russell Swigert. McDivitt was the commander of Apollo 9, having previously commanded the Gemini 4 mission when NASA performed the first EVA. David Scott was the command module pilot. He was a veteran of Gemini 8, that mission where he, along with Neil Armstrong, had been spun around after the thrusters on Gemini 8 were stuck open. Russell Swigert was the lunar module pilot. Apollo 9 would be Swigert's first mission to space. The mission profile for McDivitt, Scott, and Swigert was one of the most difficult missions that NASA had planned to date. After being launched into orbit, Scott would need to separate the command module from the third stage of the Saturn V rocket, the S-4B. He would then need to turn the command module around 180 degrees, and then come back to dock with the lunar module, which was still inside the S-4B stage. Scott would then need to pull the lunar module out and away from the S-4B. This was the easy part of the mission. Once the command module and lunar module were docked and cleared of the S-4B, the crew would need to start preparing the lunar module for use in space for the first time. McDivitt and Swigert were to crawl through a tunnel from the nose of the command module into the lunar module. They were then to activate the lunar module and check out its systems. Once that was done, it would be time to put the life support backpack, the EMU, through its paces. Swigert, still inside the lunar module, was to open the front hatch of the lunar module into space. He was then to exit the front hatch with the backpack on and step onto the lunar module ladder. The purpose of this was to confirm that an astronaut could safely exit the lunar module in space. Once outside the lunar module, Swigert's objective was to crawl all the way from the lunar module to the command module hatch from the outside. Scott, inside the command module, would open the command module hatch to let Swigert back in. This EVA would, in essence, be similar to the crew transfer mission that the Soviets had done during the Soyuz 4 and Soyuz 5 mission in January 1969. During the course of Swigert's EVA, he would also be expected to collect a number of experiments, take photos of the spacecraft exterior, and operate a television camera. After the EVA, McDivitt and Swikert were to test fly the lunar module. They would undock from the command module, leaving Scott alone in that spacecraft. Meanwhile, Swikert would fire the lunar module engine to fly away from the command module. This part of the mission represented a new type of risk in manned spaceflight. For the first time, humans would be isolated inside a spacecraft that had no ability to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. If there was a problem with the lunar module, they could not simply abort and return to Earth. If there was a problem returning to and rendezvousing with the command module, McDivitt and Swikert inside the lunar module could not come home. Before returning to the command module, Swikert was to release the descent stage of the lunar module. He would rendezvous with the command module using only the ascent stage, exactly like the astronauts would be doing if they were returning from the lunar surface. As I mentioned earlier, however, flying this tiny, awkwardly shaped, and lightweight ascent stage was going to be difficult. A specialized training center was set up for Swikert to practice flying this type of vehicle on the ground. In preparation for the Apollo 9 mission, there was one other practice that NASA had to implement for the Apollo program for the first time. A practice that had fallen out of favor after Gemini 3. The use of call signs. If you'll recall, throughout the Mercury program, NASA had allowed the astronauts to create call signs for their spacecraft. These were Freedom 7, Liberty Bell 7, Friendship 7, Aurora 7, Sigma 7, and Faith 7. NASA got uncomfortable with the call signs, starting with the very last one, Faith 7. NASA's public affairs officials feared that if something went wrong during the mission, the press would say that NASA had lost faith. Then came the Gemini program, and for the very first manned mission, Gemini 3, Gus Grissom had insisted on calling his spacecraft Molly Brown, after the unsinkable Molly Brown. When NASA headquarters suggested that he choose a different name, Grissom said he would choose Titanic. So headquarters had backed down and let Grissom have Molly Brown. As a result, though, after Gemini 3, NASA headquarters issued a memo prohibiting any further call signs for the spacecraft. So all subsequent Gemini missions just came to be known by the mission number. That practice continued into the Apollo program without a problem up until now, with Apollo 9. Apollo 9 would be the first time that NASA had two manned spacecraft in orbit since the Gemini 7, Gemini 6 rendezvous mission. During the Gemini missions, however, the two Gemini spacecraft had been launched on different rockets and could be identified by their distinct mission numbers. For Apollo 9, the command and lunar modules would be sent into space together, and they could not both be referred to as Apollo 9. They needed call signs to separately identify the command module and the lunar module. NASA decided to allow the astronauts to select the call signs once more, and the crew of Apollo 9 decided to call the command module Gumdrop, because the spacecraft shape looked like a wrapped candy when it arrived in Florida. they decided to call the lunar module Spider because of its odd, bug-like body and the spindly legs. Needless to say, these were not great names for the history books. They kind of sound like a toddler came up with them. While I'm confident that in the future, names like Discovery, Challenger, and Columbia used during the space shuttle program will be used for future spacecraft to harken back to the history of their namesakes, I don't think anyone is about to voluntarily name one of their future spacecraft Gumdrop or Spider. There was a reason why NASA headquarters took naming rights away from the astronauts, and this was a matter that headquarters would later revisit. The final preparations to launch Apollo 9 began in January 1969. NASA began rolling out the fully stacked spacecraft and launch vehicle on the crawler from the Vehicle Assembly Building to the launch pad. After a few hardware issues, Apollo 9 was cleared to launch by February 28, 1969. But the launch didn't happen. McDivitt, Scott, and Swikert were all suffering from head colds. NASA delayed the mission until March 3, 1969, when the astronauts were feeling better. When the launch did happen on March 3rd, things went smoothly. Present at the Kennedy Space Center to observe the launch was Vice President Spiro Agnew, there to represent the new Nixon administration, which began that January. Setting aside a bit of pogo, the Saturn V easily placed Apollo 9 into Earth orbit. 3 hours into the mission, David Scott separated the command and service modules from the S-4B. He pulled away and then turned around to retrieve the lunar lander. He docked with the lander, still inside the S-4B, and then pulled both spacecraft away from the S-4B. The S-4B itself fired its engine and entered heliocentric orbit, well away from the Apollo 9 mission's area of operations. At this point, McDivitt and Swikert still had not entered the lunar module. There was one further test to perform first. Scott fired up the service module engine and made a burn with the lunar module still attached to the nose of the command module. This was another critical test to confirm that the lunar module would remain docked with the command module during a burn. This was how the two spacecraft were going to get to the moon. On day two of the mission, McDivitt and Swikert put on their pressure suits and prepared to enter the lunar lander. But Swikert then encountered a serious medical problem. He started to feel nauseous, and he could not tell up from down. Then he vomited. Fortunately for everyone involved, Swikert kept his mouth shut until he could reach for a bag to deposit the stomach contents. After a moment to recover, McDivitt and Swikert went into the tunnel between the two spacecraft and entered the lunar module. This became the first intravehicular crew transfer in history. The Soviets, of course, had completed the first crew transfer ever by extravehicular means with the Soyuz 4 and Soyuz 5 mission that January. McDivitt and Swikert started to activate the lunar module, and then they closed the tunnel to the command module. Swikert, as the lunar module pilot, then separated the lunar module from the command module. He deployed the lunar lander's legs and then the lunar module flipped over so that Scott in the command module could confirm the deployment of the legs. At this point in the mission, Swikert vomited again. NASA had been allowing the media to listen in to the communications between Mission Control and the spacecraft. But now, McDivitt, as mission commander, asked for a private conversation with the ground. This began speculation that Swikert's medical condition was worsening. But after a brief conversation with the flight surgeon, the mission continued. The lunar module was then docked again with the command module. Swikert then fired the lunar module's descent stage engine while docked to test the engine without flying too far away. With the command and lunar modules docked again, it was time for the next part of the mission. Swikert's EVA from the lunar module hatch to the command module hatch from the outside. With Swikert feeling unwell, however, there was now a discussion about limiting the scope of the objective. McDivitt suggested that Swikert's EVA should be limited, and Mission Control agreed. The decision was made that Swikert would only perform the EVA during the daylight period of the spacecraft's orbit, and Swikert was to remain plugged into the lunar module's life support systems the entire time. This meant Swikert would no longer try to re-enter the spacecraft from the command module hatch. On the day of the EVA, however, Swikert started to feel better. When McDivitt told Mission Control that he thought Swikert could do more, Mission Control deferred to McDivitt's judgment as mission commander. So, Swikert was allowed to step outside of the lunar module. He stepped into the golden slippers, which were grips around his boots, that would allow him to work outside the spacecraft during the EVA. He tried the handrails that the astronauts would use to come out of the lander onto the lunar surface. He then took photographs of Scott, who had poked his head out of the command module hatch. Scott did the same and took photos of Swikert outside the lunar lander. After about an hour of this, the EVA concluded. The next day, now the fifth day of the mission, the astronauts performed the main mission objective. McDivitt and Swikert once again separated from the command module. The lunar module drifted away into a higher orbit, which from the perspective of the command module would have made the lunar module look as though it were falling behind. After the lunar module was about 180 kilometers away from the command module, McDivitt and Swikert dropped the lunar module's descent stage. Then they fired the ascent stage engine to begin the journey back to rendezvous with the command module. 2 hours later, they achieved rendezvous and docked with the command module once more. After McDivitt and Swikert entered the tunnel to get back into the command module, they sealed the tunnel to the lunar module behind them. The ascent stage of the lunar module was then jettisoned and remotely controlled to park in a higher orbit. With the test of the lunar module complete, about 90% of Apollo 9's mission objectives had been accomplished. Still, there were 5 more days left in the mission. After that time, on March 13, 1969, Apollo 9, or more specifically Gumdrop, re-entered the atmosphere and splashed down near Puerto Rico. The success of the Apollo 9 mission meant that all the equipment needed for a landing on the moon had now been flight tested. Although the equipment was ready, NASA's mission controllers felt that they were still lacking the operational experience to perform a manned lunar landing. So they prepared for one final mission before the actual landing. A mission that would take astronauts to just above the lunar surface. More about that in Apollo 10 next time.